Support for this podcast is provided by Clark University's International Development, Community, and Environment Department. Administrations change. Global problems persist. Innovate solutions to global challenges like climate change, hunger, inequity, and injustice. Turn research into action. Apply at clarku.edu/IDCE.
The refugees of Northview Heights, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Northview Heights is a public housing project in Pittsburgh. Residents there are plagued by violence, and that includes a growing number of refugees.
I don't think that's an environment that you would want to bring somebody new into this country in. You're bringing them back to another area where you can experience trauma.
Plus the aftermath of a terror attack in Kabul.
You could see hundreds of people rushing to the nearby hospital, trying to find their loved ones, and that is heartbreaking to see.
And China's obsession with selfies.
I think in China, celebrity worship and this pursuit of beauty has almost swallowed the entire generation.
Those stories and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. 2017 has been the year of disinformation, facts devalued, news consumers facing a tidal wave of propaganda, or should I say fake news. It's gotten to the point where even I get confused about what's real and what's not. Just this week, a listener wrote in to dispute something I'd said on air about Russia hacking the election. He said I should have said alleged Russian hacking. Then a colleague reminded me there's no alleged about it. Russia did interfere with our election campaign. What's not clear is whether this was in collusion with the Trump campaign. Mark Mazzetti, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist with the New York Times, has been on this story all year. So am I right about Russian interference, Mark? How do we know it actually happened?
We base it on the near universal assessment of American intelligence, law enforcement officials, foreign governments, etc., that Russia did in fact attempt to disrupt the 2016 campaign. I think that is not really in dispute at the moment, even though to a large extent the American intelligence community hasn't really, you know, shown its work to provide direct evidence of why. But after a year of reporting, I don't, and my colleagues don't, and our competitors don't really hear anyone who credibly questions whether it happened.
So what exactly did the Russians do, or at least what do we know they did?
What is pretty firmly established now is that Russians, or people working on behalf of the Russians, carried out a pretty extensive campaign of hacking Democrats, Democratic operatives, the DNC, advisors to Secretary Hillary Clinton, and spilling those emails out as a way to discredit her and her campaign. There was also a parallel effort by the Russians, or again, people working on behalf of the Russians, to spread propaganda and fake news through Facebook, Twitter, etc., that would be particularly damaging to the Clinton campaign and would, in effect, help out the Trump campaign in 2016.
Are we looking at Russia simpaticos who want to mess with American minds, or do you see, no doubt, at least some Kremlin fingerprints on this disinformation campaign?
Again, we have to sort of go with the very firm assessment of the intelligence community, which was that this was directed by the Kremlin as part of a very concerted effort to weaken Hillary Clinton and eventually, towards the end of it, specifically help Donald Trump.
Yeah, so let's talk about what actually happened in 2016, the end of the election. We can state as an incontrovertible fact that Russia attempted to influence the election. What do we know about what kind of impact this influence operation had on the election?
I mean, that's where it's a lot less clear. The intelligence community was agnostic on the idea of, you know, did it work? Did it affect the election? And it, you know, these things are very hard to determine. What leads to someone casting their vote a certain way? And I think that very essential question is still not answered and may never be answered.
All right. So then the other big question is, what do we know about connections between the Trump campaign team and Russia? Where are we at with that?
The beginning of the year, the Trump campaign and the new administration was pretty firm that there was no coordination whatsoever with any Russians whatsoever. There were no meetings, contacts, whatsoever with Russian officials in the year or so before the election. Mm. We now know that is not true. And so at the very least, we know that there were at least low-level attempts at some kind of, you know, coordination, whatever you want to call it, with the Trump campaign, between the Trump campaign and Moscow.
And I assume the questions also will be, were any of those meetings improper?
Right. I mean, whether they were improper or not, they were certainly the Trump administration and Trump advisors went out of their way to deny and conceal them. So if they were all proper, that does raise the question of why was there such a intense effort to deny and conceal them?
So finally, Mark, just some perspective here. During the Obama years, a lot of people on the right came to believe conspiracy theories about Obama's place of birth and so on. Those theories seemed crazy to people on the left, even on the center. Have we seen a new narrative this year that people on the left are crazy because they believe theories about Trump having committed treason?
You know, there's whether you compare the two, there's no question that there's been this anti-Trump fervor on the left and promoting some pretty wild aspects of this Russia story that have never been corroborated. They don't appear to have any grounding, in fact. And it has been a challenge for us and for other news organizations to not get caught up in that and to try to follow the investigation where it goes and not believe every aspect of this story, even if it might have an air of plausibility.
Mark Mazzetti of The New York Times, thanks very much.
Okay, thank you.
So we'll see where the Mueller investigation goes in the new year, but it's not going away. Nor is the decision by President Trump to recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital and moving the U.S. embassy there from Tel Aviv. The decision sparked protests in the Middle East and elsewhere and a diplomatic slap on the wrist from the United Nations. The U.N. General Assembly voted overwhelmingly to pass a resolution condemning the U.S. move. Only 7 countries voted with the U.S. and Israel on that one. They were Guatemala, Honduras, the Marshall Islands, Micronesia, Nauru, Palau, and Togo. 35 other nations abstained. Afterward, a U.S. ambassador to the U.N., Nikki Haley, invited those countries to a reception, or as The Atlantic's Matt Peterson calls it, a friendship party. Matt joins us now. So when does this party actually happen, this friendship party, Matt?
It's January 3rd, which happens to be my birthday, so I'm hoping they're going to invite me.
So what does the way the UN vote went say about U.S. diplomacy right now? What does it say about Israeli diplomacy?
It doesn't say a lot of good things about U.S. diplomacy. It says some better things about Israel. These countries that voted with the United States and Israel are small countries, Palau, Micronesia, the Marshall Islands, Nauru. These tiny countries in the Pacific all get votes on the General Assembly that are essentially equal to what the United States, France, China, other big countries have. And what that means is that in cases like this, their votes are basically up for grabs. I mean, there's a story you can tell about each of them, but by and large, these are countries that can be persuaded to vote on issues that are not on their core interests. They can be persuaded to vote one way or the other through economic or political incentives.
Just to be clear, there's not really big Jewish communities in any of these places, right?
As far as we know, there are no Jews in any of those places. But
there got to be a few.
No, maybe. Not a lot in any case. Israel's been pretty open about the fact that it has been using its development aid to try to win diplomatic votes from these countries. But really, that misses the point here. These are countries that always vote with the United States because they have an agreement with the United States to vote with it at the UN. They were countries that were governed by the United States under UN auspices after World War II. They became independent countries decades ago, but they're in these agreements where they get easy immigration to the United States and other benefits in exchange for voting with the United States at the UN. So it's easy to read too much into these votes. If these countries hadn't voted with the United States, that would be a story.
So let me ask about Togo, because, again, there's been a long friendly relationship between this tiny country in West Africa and the U.S. They're also friendly with Israel. Are these countries looking for a quick win in the international arena, cozying up to the U.S. and Israel for their own domestic consumption? And will their citizens, like, get it?
Well, in Togo, they probably won't get it. The citizens of Togo are pretty mad at their government, which has been a little embarrassing for Israel. The Israelis were supposed to hold a big Israel-Africa summit there earlier this year that they had to cancel at the last minute because the people were out protesting and the security forces in Togo were cracking down, and it was not the right moment to have a big international summit in Togo. So it's good for the government because the leader of Togo gets to go to Israel and be feted, and he gets some amount of aid. We don't really know how much in return for this. Nonetheless, he said that he was voting on this issue despite these threats from the United States. He was doing this really because of Israel and not because of the United States.
Finally, what has the Trump announcement on Jerusalem done to Nikki Haley's stature at the UN as ambassador?
Nikki Haley, I think, comes out very well for this. She drew a lot of attention for this statement that the United States is going to take names.
Right.
And if you're an ambassador like Nikki Haley, that kind of attention is really good for you, frankly, even if it's not really great for the United States. You know, I should say that the United States has a history of trying to take names here. In 2002, the United States wanted the UN to back the war in Iraq, and the UN voted it down. One of the countries that voted it down was Yemen. And the Americans were caught on an open mic at the time telling the Yemenis that was the most expensive no vote you've ever cast. And they cut off aid.
Wow.
Now, who sponsored this resolution in the General Assembly 15 years later? Yemen. So the U.S. tries to punish these countries all the time. It doesn't always stick. For Nikki Haley, however, she's got her name out there. She's shown to be an effective communicator. She's shown to be at the center of issues that matter in the UN system and on the world stage. So personally, politically for her, I think this comes out pretty well.
Although I got to say, I didn't really understand we're going to take names, the we're going to take names line. I mean, isn't that why there's a roll call at the UN?
Well, the U.S. has this history of trying to punish countries that don't vote its way, but it's just not very effective. It's not a really good way to do policy. The Israeli way of swaying people's minds seems to be much more effective, which is offer them inducements over time, have a strategy to win people over on your side.
Matt Peterson with The Atlantic, thanks very much for your time. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Can you think of a world leader who's had a more eventful year than Donald Trump? Yeah, it's a tough one. President Xi Jinping of China certainly did not fade away. In fact, Xi's year included this very high note, a party congress that elevated him to the same status as Chairman Mao. Here's my BBC colleague, China editor Carrie Gracie, with some end-of-year thoughts.
Many good things for China were made possible by Donald Trump in 2017. In his first year in office, the American president denounced the international institutions which the US had once built and led. He turned his back on the Paris Climate Change Accord and a trade agreement for the Asia-Pacific region, all of which gave China's Communist Party leader Xi Jinping a golden opportunity to present himself as the statesman of choice for clean air, common purpose, and globalization. In 2017, Donald Trump also gave China a miraculous economic gift. The candidate who told his voters he'd win against a China which was a rapist and thief on trade became the president who held back from trade sanctions and instead lavished praise on his Chinese counterpart. Mr. Trump explained his economic ceasefire as a window to let China deal with North Korea. And in 2017, Beijing did go further than ever before on punitive sanctions against Pyongyang. But that didn't stop Kim Jong-un from pushing a nuclear weapons program to threaten the American mainland. And not only did he reject Chinese pressure, he humiliated the giant neighbor which keeps his economy afloat by refusing to even meet a Chinese envoy. In 2018, the Korean nuclear crisis may worsen. On this story, it is scary to imagine the day the impossible comes true. But China's failure to stop Kim Jong-un's missile program puts it back in Donald Trump's crosshairs on trade. Soon we'll see the outcome of investigations he's ordered into alleged Chinese steel dumping and intellectual property theft. Trade turbulence between two economic superpowers could be big. But whether American threats will work is another matter. China will use every carrot and every stick in its arsenal to prevent punitive moves. Critics still warn that China must collapse under the weight of its contradictions, and doubters say its goals are impossible. But after a Communist Party Congress which put him on a par with Chairman Mao, Xi Jinping is more confident and more commanding than any Chinese leader in decades.
That's the BBC's China editor, Carrie Gracie. Later on the show, how smartphone apps are changing China's idea of beauty. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to the world. In 2017, the Trump administration drastically reduced the number of refugees allowed into the U.S., and next year that number is expected to be even lower. There's also greater scrutiny now of the programs that are resettling those refugees who are already here, and also what happens once refugees have to fend for themselves. In Pittsburgh, rising housing costs have forced some refugees into an isolated public housing project called Northview Heights. Reporter Erica Barris went there.
This is what it's like when you drive up to Northview Heights.
Good morning.
Good morning, how are you?
I'm good. How are you doing? Do I need to show you my ID?
Yes,
ma'am. Everybody who enters this place has to show ID every time. There are only two entrances into this sprawling, isolated project. That's part of the Pittsburgh City Housing Authority's efforts to keep track of who's coming and going and curtail violence and gun and drug trafficking. Bill Gandy grew up here before there were armed guards and 200 security cameras everywhere. He doesn't like the way it is now.
It just feels like a prison system to have a checkpoint in front of a neighborhood. That's already a bad start, to tell you the truth. It's like going into a military camp.
But at the same time, he gets it. After he left a few decades ago, Northview Heights, with its high rise and streets of townhouses, became way more dangerous. Even now, there's more violence than when he was growing up. This summer, he organized a reunion for people who grew up there, friends who hadn't seen each other in years, traveling from Georgia, Michigan, and right up the street.
I'm trying to remember you.
I'm a Hips.
You're a Hips.
Yeah,
okay.
You Andy?
Yeah, of course. I know all the Hips.
Bill?
Yep.
Okay, yeah, I'm Lisa.
Lisa, oh, snap. Oh, okay, I got you now.
Yeah, how you been?
I'm
David.
Good.
I'm
how
David.
You been? I'm Hips.
Those gathered remember the happier times. There were marching bands, clubs, and gun violence was unheard of. They all agree it changed when Pittsburgh's steel industry crashed, and then the crack cocaine epidemic took off. Everyone knows someone who was killed. There's even a memorial, a poster board with dozens of pictures of those lost to gun violence. Katrina Herring put it together. She left Northview Heights after her cousin was killed there in the mid-90s. Hundreds of people still live in Northview Heights, but violence has driven out lots of the old-timers, and Bill Gandy is surprised at who many of them are, Africans who came to the U.S. as refugees. He worries about them trying to start their new lives here.
I don't think that's an environment that you would want to bring somebody new into this country in after they've already left a traumatic situation. You're bringing them back to another area where you can experience trauma.
One of those newcomers is Samuel Bomera. Today, he has a massive stack of mail. He's kept it in a spare backpack until this moment, when he gets a home visit from his social worker, Viola Baguetta.
Hello.
Hello.
She's there to check in on the family and go through his mail with him. His English isn't great. While they go through a pile of papers, he holds his three-week-old twins. There's a lot to read through. Letters from the kids' schools, doctors, Social Security Administration, Medicaid, the food stamp program. Samuel Bumera and his family, wife, five kids, a sister, are from the Democratic Republic of Congo. They came to Pittsburgh after years of living in refugee camps in Uganda. Their resettlement agency found them an apartment on a bus line. Federal refugee funds paid their $900 rent for the first few months. The agency, Jewish Family and Community Services, where Viola Baguetta works, paid for the next few months.
After that, so the family was trying to pay, but you could tell that it's a struggle and we don't really have that kind of funding to sustain them forever. It's for a short amount of time when we can. We always have a little bit of emergency funding that we can tap in here and there, but it's not forever. So that's how he ended up coming here.
Here is Northview Heights, where each family only pays a third of their income. For Samuel Bomera, that's $500 a month. It was not his American dream, but it's what he could afford.
I see this way as you don't have any other choice. You have to live here because this is what you can afford. But if I have money, I want my family, my children, to be raised in a comfortable place, in a beautiful house. But here, you don't know what's going to happen. So I see this as a survival place for the time being, when I don't have any other choice.
About a decade ago, right around the time Pittsburgh had its well-touted economic resurgence, housing costs started rising. First, a few Somali families were priced out of their apartments, and they moved into Northview Heights. Other refugee families from the Democratic Republic of Congo and Burundi followed. Soon, the community became what some people call Half-African. That's half Black, half African. Leslie Eisenman runs the agency that resettled Samuel. She says refugee families moving into Northview Heights isn't ideal.
I'm mixed about it. I wouldn't intentionally want families to be in public housing if they didn't need to be.
But then again,
there's a rental housing crunch for anyone living here at the low income end of the spectrum.
And while cheaper rent is a big plus, some people say they're also drawn to the communal life here. Everyone lives close by. The new arrivals say it reminds them of how they lived in Africa and how the refugee camps were. A couple blocks away from Samuel Bomera's family lives Awais Mawila. Originally from Somalia, he's been in Northview Heights for 5 years. He says it's nice to have so many Somali neighbors. They help each other navigate this new country. While we're talking, his uncle stops by. Mawila speaks English, has a computer, and an internet connection. He's always in demand. He helps his uncle buy a plane ticket. Mawila, who, like most refugees, fled violence in his home country, doesn't feel great raising his children here, where gun violence is a regular occurrence. This summer, residents say there was a shootout between Somali and African-American teenagers.
That shooting, I don't know what the cause is, but it really affected the whole community of thinking again, saying, okay, are we again finding ourselves in the middle of such kind of situation which we were not expecting to happen in the United States?
Samuel Bomera was rattled too.
It was like being back in Congo, hearing the gunshots. And I'd think, am I back in a war zone or am I in a safe country? That's when I kind of regret being here.
Bomera wants to move, but right now his wages at the chocolate factory where he works just cover their expenses. In a good month, the most he can save is $50. For The World, Erica Barris, Pittsburgh.
Erica's reporting is supported by a fellowship from the Dart Center for Journalism and Trauma at Columbia University. Tomorrow, she'll tell us more about the community in Pittsburgh and how violence there triggers memories of the violence the refugees left behind.
When a person loses a loved one to violence, they do grieve, but it's a different type of grief because that person has been ripped away from them.
That's tomorrow, right here on the show. I'm Marco Werman. In China, apps that drastically alter how you look in a selfie are all the rage.
We tend to gawk at what's happening, you know, in China and think this is so outrageous. But I have to admit, when you use the app, you realize, huh, I do look better. And why do I not want to be the best version of myself?
China's selfie obsession, that's still ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. For years, it's been the Taliban that has put Afghans in Kabul on edge. But these days, it's the so-called Islamic State that claims most of the high-profile attacks in Kabul, the capital of Afghanistan. ISIS took responsibility for the blast this morning at a Shiite cultural center and news agency. Two suicide bombers detonated explosives inside the building, killing more than 40 people.
There was a third blast that we know, which Afghan police said was an IED, an improvised explosive device placed outside the building, aimed at maximizing casualties once people panic and leave the area.
That's Lotfullah Najafizadeh. He directs Tolo News, Afghanistan's largest 24-hour news channel. We reached out to him in Kabul today.
two of our news crews, they went to the area. They managed to get inside the building, and we could see how powerful the blast was. And there were hundreds of chairs and desks and tables that you could no longer see any evidence of. You could see hundreds of people rushing to the nearby hospital, trying to find their loved ones, either killed or wounded. And that is heartbreaking to see crying Afghan women, in particular mothers, trying to find their loved ones. Every day you leave home, you have this feeling that this might be your last day, seeing your family coming back home. But in the same time, let's not forget that the country has gone through so much in the past four decades, and the Afghan people are so hopeful. If you go to downtown Kabul tonight, you can see that a lot of people are working so hard to make a living and to make sure that tomorrow is a better day.
We also caught up with Rukmini Kalamaki, who covers ISIS for the New York Times. She says ISIS offered three motives in its statement claiming credit for today's attack.
Number one, they said that it was a Shia center. That is indeed the case. ISIS, which is a Sunni Muslim group, does not consider the Shia to be Muslims. They actually called them through a derogatory word, Rafidiya, from the Arabic root to reject, because in their view, Shia Muslims have rejected the true lineage of the Prophet Muhammad. That's the first reason. The second reason they cite is they say that it's a center of polytheism. The Shia revere certain historical figures, including Imam Ali and Imam Hussein. And in ISIS's view, this is a violation of the ideology of showing only devotion to God. And then the third reason, which might be the most important, is they claim that this particular center was a recruitment place for something called the Liwa Fatemiyun. That's an Afghan militia that has gone to Syria and has fought on the side of the Assad government, allegedly with the backing of Iran, and therefore has fought against ISIS. I don't know if that is the case, but that is what ISIS outlines as the reasons why they have hit this particular area. ISIS, their hatred of the Shia, this is the thing to keep in mind, Marco, their hatred of the Shia is almost equal, I would say, to their hatred of Christians, Jews, and the West. They really have an animosity towards them, and once again, they do not consider them Muslims. So going all the way back to the group's origins in Iraq, they have been hitting Shia sites, and they're now doing that all over the world.
Now, President Trump campaigned on defeating ISIS, and in recent days, he's been tweeting about the success of his administration in the fight against ISIS. Does ISIS pay much heed to those Trump tweets?
I don't think they pay much heed to those Trump tweets. And the thing to keep in mind is President Trump is correct. There has been an enormous rollback of ISIS's presence in Syria and Iraq. They have lost the majority of their territory there. But what we are missing in those statistics is the growth of ISIS abroad. So, for example, CENTCOM, which is in the Pentagon, has just announced, I think it was last week or the week before, that the number of ISIS fighters in the country of Yemen has doubled in the past year.
Wow.
Doubled. Right? In Afghanistan, for example, ISIS is now, at least in Kabul, a greater threat to civilians than the Taliban is. They've carried out more attacks in recent months than the Taliban has. In Niger, as you know, several Green Berets were killed by what officials are telling us is an affiliate of ISIS. And in the Sinai, in Egypt, just a few weeks ago, we saw probably one of the highest single-day death tolls ever in an attack that we believe was led by ISIS on a mosque there, where more than 300 people were killed the same day. So the potency of ISIS abroad remains, and if anything, it seems to be growing in specific theaters.
And Rukmini, you see this as cause and effect. As ISIS loses territory in Syria and Iraq, they are deliberately moving into, well, places like Afghanistan in a bigger way than they were before.
I sort of reject that thesis, because if you go back to the origins of their affiliates, these affiliates were growing at the very point when ISIS was in its strongest position in Iraq and Syria. So the notion that they're somehow redirecting resources as a result of losing ground, or that they're doing this as revenge, doesn't really hold water if you look at the physical timeline. Now, what is true is that Syria and Iraq has become a very inhospitable place for them now. Recruitment resettlement to Syria and Iraq is down to nil. So it is logical that in a place like Libya, in a place like Afghanistan, in a place like Yemen, if you're somebody from, let's say, the West who wants to join this group, that you would consider going to those theaters as opposed to their former base in Iraq and Syria. And that is related to the loss of territory.
Rukmini Kalamaki covers ISIS for The New York Times. Thanks so much for being with us, Rukmini.
My pleasure, Marco. Happy New Year.
So check this out. More than half of the selfies uploaded on Chinese social media are believed to have been edited using apps made by just one company. It's called Meitu. That translates to beautiful picture. The company's been around for less than a decade, but as Jia Yongfan reported in her recent story, China's Selfie Obsession for The New Yorker, Meitu is quite literally transforming the face of China.
They have a battery of apps with names like Selfie City, Beauty Plus, and they are all in the service of making Chinese faces more beautiful, or allowing users to brighten their eyes, sharpen their chin, to heighten their cheekbone, to delete their freckles, and almost any other beauty procedure you may think of.
You actually visited Xiamen, China, where Meitu is headquartered, and you spoke with the company's founders. What did they tell you about how they choose what sort of features to include in the apps? Like, what do people want to change about themselves?
Right. Well, Meitu executives like to say that they are not in the business of changing Chinese standards of beauty, that they are only responding to the user data they've collected. But everyone in China seems to want to look almost a Japanese Barbie doll, if you can imagine it, you know, almost anime-like in their features, with these huge eyes, a very high nose bridge, and super pale skin.
But as you found while reporting the story, those standards, those ideals, they change over time. I mean, that Japanese anime look, popular, but changing too, right?
Right. I mean, it is subject to, you know, Japanese, Korean, and increasingly we've been seeing the arrival of what the Chinese term the Euro-American wave, where the Chinese recognize that we don't want to look so exaggerated that we look fake. But it's still toward the direction of paler skin, bigger eyes, taller nose. Those tend not to change in the Chinese beauty ideal.
And I gather there's even a name for this kind of face that can be perfected through these apps.
Exactly. The name is Wang Hong Lian, which means internet celebrity face. And if you can imagine Kim Kardashian's face being the model that every woman in America aspires to, that would be it. The sense that her features become the platonic ideal that everyone strives towards.
So it's one thing to alter your face digitally with these apps, but you write that this internet celebrity face look, some people are actually going as far as to get plastic surgery to achieve it.
Yes, and that very much is, I think, a natural progression. When on Meitu, you can make your eyes really large and you can shave down your jaw bones. That's also another popular procedure. Yes. And it's one that's actually not even permitted for the most part in the U.S. But in China, the rules are looser and anything and everything is doable in the name of beauty.
You even got your own consultation. What was that like? You went to a plastic surgery hospital. They talked to you about what you would have to do to kind of achieve this ideal?
Right. I went into it thinking that I'm a relatively young woman, and then they might have a few suggestions for what I can do. But the suggestions that my very kind, thorough plastic surgeon had for me was that I should almost alter every single feature of my face.
Had you like played around with Meitu before that consultation and seen like different images of yourself?
I did. And I have to admit, when I looked at how much smoother my face was, how my eyes were just a little bit brighter, and how my cheekbones were a little bit more symmetrical, I was encouraged. I mean, we tend to gawk at what's happening in China and think this is so dark and outrageous. But I have to admit, when you use the app, you realize, huh, I do look better, and why do I not want to be the best version of myself?
That sounds like it was a revelation for you, like you were not expecting that.
I wasn't. And also, when I walked out of that consultation, even in my capacity as a journalist, knowing that this is a story I'm reporting on, I have to admit to feeling a real sense of despondence. Like, maybe I've been deluding myself, walking around looking like a gargoyle. And I can only imagine how infectious that feeling must be when you live immersed in a society where everybody is doing that.
Well, I mean, in modern Chinese history, I'd love to know what the before and after is here. Like, during the heights of communism, did vanity have a place in China? And how much has that changed in the last 20 years? Like, could you imagine anyone taking a selfie during the Cultural Revolution?
Right. I think vanity played a greater part than we'd like to imagine. Chairman Mao did marry an actress. That was the wife that tried to kind of overthrow him in the end, Jiang Qing. And senior communist officials did pick the prettiest girls from dance troupes to marry. But by and large, because the party was responsible for filling your rice bowl, society was just not nearly as competitive. Life wasn't necessarily luxurious, but everyone had what was known as the iron rice bowl. The government gave you a job and a place to live, and you didn't have to strive and work so hard just to make sure that, you know, you could buy an apartment in Beijing and have a presentable job. But for the younger generation, they're stepping into a void. There's nothing, there's no safety net. They only have themselves to rely on. And there's this sense that they have to invest in themselves, in their bodies, in upgrading their bodies in order to be assured of a comfortable existence.
It's weird. It sounds like they're struggling with both individualism and conformity at the same time.
Very much so. And I think for a lot of younger Chinese, they would say that Meitu is granting them a measure of freedom. But I think, you know, the Chinese 23-year-old might not realize the way that larger social economic forces are being exerted upon them.
At the end of the day, Jiayang, do you think Meitu-era China is really any different from, say, Kardashian-era U.S.? Because go on social media, you see plenty of people using makeup filters and also going as far as to get plastic surgery to look like Kim Kardashian or her sisters.
Right. I think it's a matter of degree. I think that in China, it's taken to a whole new extreme. Here in the U.S., there are lots of celebrity chasers, but there are also other ways of expressing yourself as a young person. You can engage in politics. You can be a social activist. I think in China, celebrity worship and this pursuit of beauty has almost swallowed the entire generation of Chinese youths. And I think that's because you're not allowed a political voice. You're not encouraged to participate in political dissent. So you're almost pushed to a few interests that are acceptable.
Finally, I feel there's a chicken and egg question here because as the co-founder of Meitu told you, what they're really interested in is user data. Is that what this is really all about?
They are interested in user data, and they have told me that they want to establish a firm user base. The CEO of the company went so far as to tell me that in 5 years, he hopes that 80% of the world will be using Meitu. But I don't know that they have any nefarious aims for user data. I think they want to use their influence to harness as many users as possible and then think about how to monetize that.
Jiayang Fan with The New Yorker telling us about her story, China's selfie obsession. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed being here.
So yesterday, after our story on 10 years since the death of Pakistan's Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto, we heard from some of you on social media. Here was one note on Twitter. I recall waking up to the news of her death on my birthday. I admired her and believed that if alive, she would have led Pakistan in a positive direction. I know where I was, right here in what was then our very new studio in Boston, shaken by the news and then the pictures of what turned that day in 2007 into a bloody political rally. So what are your memories of that day? Tweet at me, at Marco Werman, or tweet at the show. We are at PRI, The World. The World's Shirin Jafari joins me for the next few minutes. Shirin, where are we? What are we hearing?
We are, Marco, at what's called a pre-clearance station at the Pearson Airport in Toronto.
Yes, thank you.
I recently went through the station on my way back to the U.S. And if you pay close attention, you notice that this place is manned by U.S. agents, not Canadians. And there are also signs that tell you you are entering a U.S. pre-clearance area.
Pre-clearance, what does that mean exactly? It sounds like one of those airport code words like deplaning.
The idea behind these stations is that you go through the U.S. customs and immigration process before you even board a plane to the U.S. Mm. That means you can fly into any airports within the U.S. You don't have to land at an airport that has a customs and immigration facility.
Okay, that sounds kind of convenient given how much time you wait on the other end before you get on a plane, and then you don't have to do it when you arrive. So is this totally new, or has this system been in place at some airports already?
The idea for these stations came about in the 1950s, actually. Back then, a lot of the points of entry to the U.S. didn't really have any customs and immigration facilities. And so the U.S. decided to set up these posts in a couple of different places. They set them up in Canada, Ireland, the Bahamas, Bermuda, Aruba, and more recently in the United Arab Emirates. So if you think about it, these stations are like tiny American islands on foreign soil, kind of like embassies. And initially, the point of these stations was to help passengers clear customs. But over the years, that changed, and they became more and more involved with security and the immigration process.
And how did that happen?
After 9/11, and more recently in the past couple of years, officials at the Homeland Security began to see these pre-clearance stations as places where we can stop potential terrorists from even boarding flights and coming to the U.S. So they wanted to build more and more of them. Just listen to Jay Johnson, the former Secretary of Homeland Security, speaking about this last year.
At present, we have this pre-clearance capability at 15 airports overseas. And last year, through pre-clearance, we denied boarding to over 10,700 travelers, or 29 per day, seeking to enter the United States. As I said here last year, we want to build more of these. In May 2015, I announced 10 additional airports in 9 countries that we've prioritized for pre-clearance.
And the Homeland Security now wants to go even further and go beyond airports. They want to add these stations in places like train stations and bus stations. Some already exist, but they want to add more.
And will the U.S. be able to do that?
Negotiations with a couple of countries like the Netherlands, Belgium, and Norway started under President Obama, and the talks were ongoing. These countries were considering it. That's until President Trump took office, and the dynamics really changed. Trump talked a lot about limiting the number of immigrants coming into this country. He talked about, quote, extreme vetting, and then he issued the travel ban.
Right, that was the ban that stopped people from 7 Muslim-majority countries from coming to the U.S. that's now been upheld in court.
Yeah, and some of the leaders in these countries and some of the civil rights activists began to wonder, do we really want to intentionally allow these American agents to come and work on our soil? And then they also asked, how are these new policies going to impact the rights of our citizens?
Yeah, I'll bet they were asking those questions. So did any of these countries just say, no, we're not going to go along with this?
Yeah, in fact, the Netherlands, for example, ended the negotiations. But other places like Canada, they've been struggling with this. And let me give you an example as to why having these stations on foreign territory can be tricky. Before, the agents who'd manned these stations weren't armed and didn't carry any guns. Now the U.S. says it wants to allow them to carry guns. Mm. For Emily Gilbert, that raises red flags. She researches immigration and border security at the University of Toronto.
And the United States has passed legislation to allow those border agents to operate in Canada, but also not only to operate in Canada, but be to subject to U.S. jurisdiction. So anything that they do is subject to U.S. jurisdiction, even though they're on Canadian soil.
So imagine, she says, one of these agents shoots a Canadian at one of these stations. What's going to happen next? How is this going to play out in the courts? Basically, Gilbert says the U.S. is extending its powers beyond its borders.
Yeah, well, it'll be really interesting to see how this continues to unfold. The World's Shireen Jafari, thanks very much.
You're welcome, Marco.
I know we're cutting it close, but in this last week of 2017, we're sharing our favorite music picks of the year with you. Today, the world's Brandy Fulwood tells us about an artist with roots in Ethiopia who this year blazed her own path with a very personal album.
End of the year lists are so difficult for me, but Kalela's Take Me Apart is without a doubt one of my favorite albums of 2017. It's analytical, but also reflective. As a whole, the album amasses digital, physical, imagined, and desired spaces. Take Me Apart builds on a number of influences, pulling sounds from R&B, dance pop, soul, and jazz. Although I've hardened, darling, my guard is down. It creates this dazzling, glossy, and piercing sound that adheres to Kalela's voice in such a beautiful way. Kalela processes the decay of a past love through lyrics and production, carving out ideas of lust, confidence, fear, pain, and finally moving on. And maybe I've listened to it too much, but I can feel this song. It's an embodiment of sultry and cosmic. Begging your pardon, told myself I needed time, but my discipline is slipping head first, 'cause baby with your love. Blue Light is this glacial and expansive foundation where Kalela's voice echoes through chambers. And I love it. For the world, I'm Brandy Fulwood.
Kalela brings the curtain down today. We'll have more of our picks for you tomorrow. Check out all our musical favorites of 2017 over at PRI.org. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Thanks for being with us.
PRI, Public Radio International.